Recording. Episode one. Finally, after weeks and weeks of talking about it.
Right. We're finally here, man.
Yeah, bro.
First one.
Yeah.
You want to tell people how this all came about? How you sprung this on me?
Is it not my fault?
Yeah, I was just chilling, doing my own thing, and then this message came over like, hey, remember that idea we talked about months ago?
Ish. Well, basically, it was all the conversations we have, like the weekly conversations we have, like almost every Sunday. And it's some interesting, at least to me, content. Like, I don't know about the audience, but to me, it's interesting content. So I was like, hey, you know, why don't we turn this into a podcast? And Tudor was like, nah, fuck that shit. I don't want the exposure.
I like my privacy, man.
But now you're a public figure, so live with it.
Hey, you know, that the first thing I thought about was like, this is the first time people are going to hear how, you know, Canadian my accent has become. I had carefully hidden it for so long, and now the cat is going to be out the bag, so this is going to be very interesting. to the people who do end up seeing this, yeah, it's been 10 years, fucking deal with it.
Yeah, can't blame you for that.
This is interesting, man. This is going to be fun. This is going to be fun. We do talk about a lot of shit, though. That is for sure. We can go for hours talking about random stuff that doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme, but...
Yeah, true. I think we probably logged in probably a year of just conversations. And this is the first time we're like, hey, let's put them onto a recording. Let's see what happens.
Are you ready for people to go into our weird paradigm of content that we gather for ourselves and, you know, put out there?
I'm not. But you're never ready. You're never, ever ready to do stuff like this. You only know when you're in it. So I guess we'll find out.
I guess we will. So I know you had a topic that you wanted to get started with, just to, you know, let people in, ease them in.
Ease them in.
You want to? I don't know if it's going to be easing. I think that's really just, you know, throwing all the craziness into it. But, you know, that's what we're here for, right?
Yeah. Well, I was like, we were having this chat, like, was it last week or the week before? And we're talking about, like, how we draw babies are now, like, in our 30s or close to our 30s. And, yo, the world they told us existed, bullshit. Like unmitigated bullshit. Because you remember, like, back in the day, even in, like, career guidance, they were like, oh, you're going to have a career by the time you're, when was it, by 25, you'll have a career out of college. You'll be married by, like, 26, 27, and you have kids, like, entering your 30s. And I'm here on that, and I'm like, okay, where is the degree? Two, where is the marriage? Because I feel like the world they prepared us for was and is doesn't exist. Like,
yeah.
I'm speaking mostly in the Zimbabwean context where, like, we lived in micro environments. I know you know this. Like, we lived in the circles that our parents were around. So those, like, then became, like, what we then fed off in terms of who we are and whatnot and kind of shaped an impression. And then we also lived in, like, another micro society of the school we went to because of both ex-John's boys. So you already know, hence, why this is north of Samora. This is Salala Central. Yeah.
We got to write into that. Make sure that it's a theme that we're not trying to, you know, we got to be authentic. That's my shit, right? That's the whole theme of it, is to be authentic. So, oh, yeah, north of Samora. That's where we're from. That's where we were raised.
Yeah, and then, like, we then lived in these, like, super small societies in our own homes where,
right,
like, your family then dictated out of the influences that they had and their perception of right, wrong, good, bad, you know, what you were supposed to be. So I don't know about you, because I know what we talked about, but I want you to, like, go through, like, your own experience with this, because mine is quite long and I don't want to hog the mic for too long.
Yeah, look, I've waxed about this before, but my whole experience with it was just, I think it was a delayed reaction. It wasn't until I got out here that I realized the way we were, you know, what we were prepared for kind of just, it vanished, you know? I think for you know, when you're in the climate, when you're in the culture in Zimbabwe, when you're growing up in it, it makes sense to you, right? Like the way your parents, you know, you only know what you see. And what we saw was, like you're saying, the culture of our parents, what they saw, what they were taught, and how they understood the world to be, you know. And I lived in an environment, at least with people, or at least a person who believed his ideal of what the world was, you know, was like, it was a formula that he had, you know, that had worked for him, worked for people before him, and this is just a formula that works, and it's the only one that works, and if you follow it closely, you know, when you follow my footsteps kind of thing. And, you know, my dad, you know, that's who he was, that's how he was taught, that's how he was kind of raised and stuff. So it was understandable that he just, that's all he knew. And he tried to really, let's just say, forcefully instill that into us, to put it kindly. And, you know, I think we, you know, there was never really a room to find, you know, him, you know, to find a way to tell him or to get him to understand, hey, man, there's plenty of ways that you can do this. But, you know, that's going side of the whole point. The, you know, it was the growing up in it. He taught us that life was ABC. This is what you do. This is where you get to. This is where you finish. And I remember it was when I was trying to do my degree, or trying to decide what my degree was, where, you know, it was the goal. You know, remember back then, all they told you was, hey, you get out, you're a doctor, you're an accountant. If you find anything in between those two, you're set for life and a career, you know? That was, you know, at least that was the speech that I was given and was drilled into me. And so you kind of, you know, at least for me, I kind of just, by sheer pressure, decided, yeah, you know, financial degree, that's my shit. You know, I can do that. Fuck, you know, but it was, you know, and then you get in there and you're like, and I'm like doing this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, this isn't, you know, formulas and all this. This isn't for me. And then it was really just about the kind of, you know, the characters that really get into finance and the kind of mind you have to be to understand all of that. And I just wasn't that kind of person, you know? And so I think we, you know, but it was instilled into me that from a young age that this is the goal, you know, get into a business, probably do finance. That will set you up as a financial advisor or controller. Then you can specialize. Then you can go into banking. And then you're in investment banking. And it was a whole plan that was kind of set out. And there was never really an environment, at least in my environment, where it was like, maybe we should discuss this. I mean, I'm the one doing it after all. I'm the one doing it after all. I mean, you know, you're not there in this test, in the exam study. This is me, my life, Kasa. So, you know, it wasn't until I got out there and then you started, I think the world kind of shifted to a technology point, you know, to more technology based. And there was all these different things and avenues. And it was like around 2012 when like influencers were a thing, you know, like you're seeing people making money from being able to market themselves. And that's when I was just like, marketing, that's a very versatile topic that I think I can be good at that. And so, you know, and I just, it was just my understanding of where the world was kind of shifting towards, and that we were now getting to a positive place where, not that it didn't exist before, that anybody could find success in this world by doing what they wanted and what they loved, and that it was really a decision of figuring it out for yourself and doing that instead of following somebody else's plan just because they've lived longer, you know? Because we got to a point where information was, you know, I don't, so I'm hugging the thing here, but remember when information just became there for us?
Yeah.
Like before, you know, remember the dial-up days? Jeez, TV on dial-up, you know, and it's like computer was set time, you know, you had to log onto the computer at a set time. You didn't want to keep everything busy. It was one thing. You had to plug it in, and then it'd be like 1 hour at 6 before somebody else comes on and has to get on. So that's, you know, so information wasn't really there for us to kind of know all the different things. And Isusu in Zimbabwe, you know, we didn't, all we saw was what we saw on TV, you know, for the most part, and the world we lived in. And that's the shit that, you know, that was taught to us. And that's the way we understood the world. And then we got out, at least for me, and you started seeing all these different things and experiencing all these different cultures and people and characters. And all their different stories of success. And you just realize that it's, you know, there's multiple ways in which you can walk this path and not just the one that I was taught. And that's just me as a person, because I always looked at people who've lived more, who had more experiences as being at a place where I didn't need to learn from them. They've walked the path, so their path must be, that was the mindset that I was kind of brought up in. It wasn't, you know, one way I could think for myself. And once I was separated, you know, from all of that and I got out, it just became evident that, look, I had to relearn, kind of I had to find my place in the world, because I don't think I was taught for all of this, you know, some of the things about being able to think for yourself and see all these things. Because, you know, once you're alone, right, the first time for me, that's where all this shit can happen to you. Now it's real. There's no insulation. There's no whatever. You're in the world here where, you know, this, the criminal system, you know, the justice system, it works out here. So, you know, everything works out here. Like, I mean, it doesn't work to perfection, but in comparison to what we had, everything works. Trouble is there. Things work the way they, you know, the way they're supposed to, the way you saw them. So you had to figure out what the world was like. And I had to then refigure out this world of technology now, where it's like, there's a business here and there's things you can get into. And there's many different ways in which now it's gone to a place where I didn't even think it was possible. Like, now we're doing a podcast, being able to have this conversation, right? So it was for me, just like, you know, to summarize all of that, for me, it was just, right, I grew up in an environment that kind of taught me that this is the way the world works. But it was really a narrow perspective of everything. Not just from the person I was learning from, but just because of my environment. You know, where we were at in Zimbabwe, we didn't have access to all the things that people had access to. And so once we got out, at least started to see it, and it was around the time when things were shifting, you know, the early teachings, whatever, those 18 years of life lessons that we had learned reach a point, you know, to reach this end point, and we had to then learn new things about the world and adapt to it.
Yeah. It's strange that, like, we were supposed to learn these hardened ways. Because I had the same conversation that you had, you know, the whole, yeah, you know, your degree will open up so many doors. And that's not to say it won't. Like, and this is not me unfairly bashing. And I think Tudu said the same. Like, that's how they were raised. Like, the boomers, the Zim boomers, that's how they were raised. So you can't really
fault them for that.
But it's a situation where they first put us in these schools that exposed us to a lot. Like, a lot, a lot. So you're like, you guys are spending over $3,000 a term to, like, send us to these schools. And you want us to stick to the plan, yet we're being exposed to, like, so many different ways of thinking. Is that okay? So what do you want me to do here? And then they send you off to uni, where you're going to another country, and you have to acclimatize to a different culture, to a different way of doing things, to greater access. So would you have never expected our perspective to shift, to think that this was not enough? That always baffles me, because when I had that convo when I was back and I was in South Africa, you see a lot of stuff in SA, man. Like, you see the way people are on campus hustling. It's not even a grimy hustle. It's people starting businesses, startups. People saying, you know what, I'm 1 year into this degree, but I have a passion for, you know, photography or videography, or I like buying and selling, or what's this new crypto thing that's coming up? And let me get into it. And then you realize how far behind you're in, because dipping your toe into that shit is weird. Because for me, it was uncharted territory. I was like, I had never made an independent decision for myself. Everything was pre-planned. So I was just chilling there like, okay, this sounds like fun, but I'm afraid of the risk, because I've been on this, like, safe path that I was told, just do what you need to do on this path and it's going to get you there. And then at the end of the day, you see, like, I knew this dude who actually dropped out and started a business. And he was like, I'm not wasting money paying a university for something that, for information I'm not going to need. And that's another conversation we never really had, to be honest. That uni is just uni. Like, it's an experience. Once you get out, and, okay, even you, were you not told, like, the stuff you learned at uni, like, dump it? You're going to learn what your job actually is now.
Man, look, the thing is, like, uni, you get it, you get to it, right? And then the first 2 years is just learning how to pass.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It's the first 2 years is just learning how to pass. And then afterwards, it's still learning how to pass, but you pick up some things. But by the end of it, right, you get out and you're like, at least I got out and I was just like, now I'm in, you know, digital marketing. I was like, one class we did in digital marketing, a whole marketing degree, right? One class, one topic where we touched on digital marketing. It was one chapter. One chapter. And the moment I got out, I got into a digital marketing, a digital marketing computing website company startup thing with James. Yeah. And then, you know, it's been building ever since then, and I've been having to relearn, or he's learning a whole new topic of marketing that was only covered in one chapter.
Yep.
So it's shit like that, where it was like, you know, uni was just an experience, because everything we learned in it, at least for me, just the degree I did, everything I learned in it, just concepts here and there, but the shit I'm in now was literally just one subsection of the entire course. You know?
I think it's different. It's different for like the sciences and stuff, where like what you are learning is pretty much what you're going to be doing. I think
that's the
beauty of the sciences. But in when you're in business, especially business administration, accounting, I think, is another one that you're learning pretty much your job. But stuff like human resources management, PR, there are certain situations that they can never teach you in a class. There's certain, you know, things you need to manage yourself. You know, for example, understanding organizational culture. Which is something that I wish my parents had told me when I was young. And like, yo, bro, you're going to walk into companies that are going to be different from what you think. They're going to want you to do things in a different way than you think. You're going to have to kind of betray the way you think and, you know, toe the company line, because that's how you're going to elevate in business. And they never told us that qualifications only get you to a point. You know, hitting 10 A's, 5 A's, O level, A level is great. Like, it's a flex. Like, that. Remember that white blazer, that academic full colors? That was a flex. But that means...
That was a flex. That was a flex, though. That was a flex. When you get that for the, especially for the academics, they used to walk around with those blazers with pride, bro. With absolute pride. You can understand. In that moment, I would have flexed, too. But yeah. You're right. You know, you get out and then, you know, you get into the real world, and then, you know, like now there's people with PhDs who, you know, make less than people without PhDs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like in the same, like I had a friend who was literally in a tech section of a university, and, you know, he had a higher, his role, he didn't have a PhD, he was still doing his degree, and he had a higher role, higher paying, you know, role in the company. Or in that department, than some people who had like PhDs and stuff. So, you know, that's, you know, so I mean, it's not to say, you know, there's no value in all of that in certain, you know, certain degrees and stuff. It's just to say, hey, bruh, in some industries, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Experience is the thing that gets you in the door. The qualifications are the ones that secure the business, but experience, for the most part, you know, it's just that's what people look for, at least from what I've seen.
I feel you, man. It's the same way, like when friends of mine graduated and then they started looking for jobs, like when I was a first year. And then, like, this dude called me, he's like, bro, you know what? These guys are asking for 3 years job experience. There's nothing below 2 years job experience. And I'm like, well, we kind of knew this, didn't we? Like, the expectation was just getting higher. They want people actually know what they're doing instead of having to teach someone how to do it, which then that's when that light bulb hit in my head that as much as like Zim parents and the boomers tried to do their best, they didn't see the changes quick enough to be like, and again, this is not a fault of their own. The pressures they grew up with were different, as well as the country that they were growing up in. Because if you're not from Zimbabwe, you won't understand what we're talking about. But if you're from Zim, you get it. Like if you're alive from 06 to like 2012, you know that nothing was conventional. But they thought that was the safest path. But even if you got the degree, like I know people who've literally shelved their degrees and put them up as just, you know, like, you remember when we got our driver's license when we were like 16, 17? And it's just something you put up on the wall. It just allows you to do something else, but you're not necessarily doing it if you don't have a car. So people then started shelving their degrees and doing other things, because they're like, you know what, I wasted 3 years of my life. And it's not waste, because some people see value in academia, and those people, you know what, do a thing. Because like, even if you get a PhD, you're not learning that amount. You know, it's fine as long as you find value in it. But if you're told that's the only way, that's the only way to succeed in terms of monetary value, no, it's complex. Because in terms of monetary value, trying to get a job in the master's degree, and it's your first job, you're overqualified for what they have for you. You're going to have to take a pay cut, to be honest, to like fit in.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah. It cannot be overstated just how much that shift, how quick that shift was. Because I truly believe before everything went digital, there was value, not value, but like it was the safest path was you had to get a degree, education, and then be able to then, you know, use that degree to get a higher qualified degree. Like you do a post grad, you do an MBA or something. And then, you know, that sets you up for, you know, high paying job. Like you don't have to start entry level. You can then get to a, like, you know, a junior level or something like that, you know? So there was value. There was real, I swear, there was real, you know, value in that advice and that drilling that into us. It just, everything shifted. Everything began to shift because they made it seem, at least the environment I grew up in, the people I was around, all made it seem like academia was the pathway to get out of Zim. Because between, like you're saying, 06 and 12, hey, bruh, things went all over the place in Zimbabwe, bruh.
Yeah.
Like, we were millionaires and trillionaires and, hey, man. Woo! Parent checks, hey, Shamar, hey, bruh. I remember the days where all the rentals were, you know, going outside of the country just to bring groceries. Like, I remember that period, bruh. That was... I think about that all the time, man. It was real, bruh. Like, and I mean, it's scary that that's, you know, what's going on now in SA. It's just, you know, like a microcosm, you know, not a micro, but like just that's still going. But anyway, you know, I think there was real value in what they were teaching us back then. And that was the pathway to success. It's just for some of us, or at least for people who understood that they were winning more back then, right? It wasn't, for them, it was all about security and being able to, you know, have security for us. And for that, I can be like, yeah, I get it. You know, you understand that. But it was the lack of trust, at least for me, in my experience, that maybe, just maybe, there's a different pathway here. And that, you know, and that maybe, just maybe, I might be able to get it done, you know, whether I'll have to learn on my own and be able to grind. Yeah, sure. You know, we'll have to, you know, grind through it and go through hell. But, you know, for me, it was like, you know, because my dad was in his own thing at the time. Like he was doing his own thing. He had left the company and did his own thing, but he did it after years and years in the industry. So he felt like that was the pathway, right? You get years and years of experience and you do your own thing. And I was like, maybe that can be accelerated because maybe there's many different things I can do, right? But for them, there was no security in that. There's no security. I remember my mom kept saying security, find a secure job, find, you know, there was always a sense of being secure and having that blanket, a safety blanket that, so if you had academia and you had a degree, you always have that shit to fall back on. And so I think for me, when I got into my degree, I was like, okay, there's the merit. But after 2 years in there, I was like, all right, I'm going to give them one. And I'll think about the next one. I'll think about the next one. And by the time I got to year four, I was like, you're never getting the next one. I gave you these 4 years for this one. I got value from it. But now I'm moving into something else and I don't need this for that. So, you know, but then, yeah, that's why I never saw value for what I was going to do in going to get another one. Because I was still going to have to get entry level anyway, because half the job said, we need 3 years of experience. I mean, I've been doing school for 5 years. How am I going to get, like, how do I get the experience? You know what I mean? I'm going to start entry level at that point and then move into that position. But I spent 5 years getting this degree that they assured me was going to get, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? So, at least that was the logic in my mind, where it's like, I'm still going to have to work this experience to get into these jobs because they don't want somebody coming in to a high-paying, very critical position and they don't have the experience to do that job. Like, I'm not going to hire you to come do a job you don't have experience doing, but you have knowledge of it. Yeah, but you don't know how to do it. You haven't been with customers. You haven't dealt on a day-to-day, you know, calling clients. No, you've been in school learning how to do that. You haven't done it. And I guess, you know, for me it was kind of a testament to kind of my independence that I had to learn how to do things. And so I found more value in going to learn how to do things than to spend another year and a half in school.
Yeah, true that, man. And again, like it's the degrees that we were told to pursue. Like those are the ones who are most telling to me. It's like like there's an Indian stereotype of you have to be a doctor or be in computer science or to be, you know, deemed as successful. In Zim is pretty much the same. And I think British, former British colonies go through the same thing, where if you're not a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, or any one of those, you know, very well-established professions for their generation, you weren't successful. And it was the flex they would go around to their friends and say, oh yeah, my son's a doctor. My son's a lawyer. He's, you know, he's at this firm and stuff like that. But it was, those professions are, they're great. We need them. Like, it's not like we don't need them. They're people who actually have a passion for doing it. And for those people, you know, do your thing. But for people who were actually told that this is your only avenue and they're different passions, I feel like that was not the right advice to give at the time. I feel like, and I'm saying this kindly because I bounced around professions because it was law, business administration, then medicine. So I have
I forgot about that.
So like, you remember how difficult it was for me to like explain the kind of journey from SA to Ukraine and be like, yeah, I'm going to do medicine. And
I don't I'm glad you brought that up because that was the most random shit ever. It was 2 years. I was messaging this guy for 2 years. And we were just back and forth on app, just keep in touch day to day or whatever. Mm. And he's like, yeah, I'm in Midrand. I'm like, all right, cool. I don't know. That's where you were. I think that's where you were.
Yeah.
And then randomly, because you used to go to summers, right? You used to go to Zim. And then you go to the farm and you go off the grid for like 6 months or something. Yeah. Just straight up disappear. And then you'd resurface. And you resurface with some 38 Chakuti number. I was like, who is this? He's like, oh, it's Valentine. I'm in Ukraine. And I'm like,
yeah, I remember the confusion.
How did we get here?
I remember the confusion. Remember that Viber call we had when Viber was a thing? And then I was trying to explain logic to it. I'm like,
Viber. Yeah.
Bruh. You know, the authorities pulled rank. This is like something that I'm just doing because they pulled rank. And to be honest, I enjoyed my time there. I enjoyed the experience. I enjoyed learning.
Man.
A lot.
That culture must have been a... Hey, that culture, bruh. You must have been really in it. You must have seen some things.
Hey,
I spent a semester with Ukrainians and Russians. I know how they are. I know how they get down.
Yeah, bro. It was a crazy experience. I think, you know, in retrospect, I wouldn't have done it. Like myself, if I had the choice. Because I was asked a question by one of my professors. Like, dude, would you take all the money you had spent in your journey here and started a business? And I'm like, yep, in a heartbeat. Knowing what I know now, pretty much. But it's not like I hate the experience. The experience was great because I got to meet like extraordinary people, very intelligent, very capable people in their fields, very underappreciated people, super smart. I also got to learn about another culture. And although Ukraine is not necessarily Europe in the traditional context, it's on the continent. But when people talk about Europe, especially Zimbos, Ukraine is not the first country people think about. But being in proximity and then learning from like seeing a bunch of people from like Poland, Germany, like getting that cultural tinge, getting that perspective, and then, you know, getting stuff like the learning about music and books, you know, because I'm into books, so getting a whole different, like, library to then dip into all these cultures and people, that was cool. Problem is, it was a damn waste of my time. Because the whole time there, I was antsy. I'm like, this is not what I really want to be doing. Like, yo, like, I see the value. I see people be like, oh, you'd be paid X amount. I'm like, dentists commit suicide in mass. They're like freaking lemmings. They just jump off cliffs every year because it's a soul-sucking career. Like, if you've got a passion for it, do it. If you don't lie to yourself. Like, just don't. I spent 5 years lying to myself, like, ah, you know what? I'm going to open up a surgery. I'm like, year five, I was like, no, listen, I'm out. Like, when I'm out, when I leave, don't expect to see me back because I am so far done. And it brought me to what I actually wanted to do with my life. And it was questions that I asked myself. Now, juxtaposing to this, the parents were like, bruh, what are you doing with your life? Like, where you at? Like, you know, you had expectations, X, Y, Z. And I'm like, it's difficult for me to explain to you right now because I don't know. He's like, no, you're wasting time. You could have been, I'm like,
See, that was the thing. It was like, there was this timeline that everybody, I don't know if you got a time, that timeline used to fuck me up, man. It's like, you had to do this. By this, you're wasting your time. And it's like, yo, it wasn't until I got into a culture where there were people who were literally taking their time to figure out what they were doing and they were working while doing that. And I was like, see, we weren't taught that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like, the culture we had, you know, at least in, for me, my experience, the independence wasn't taught to about getting your own, working and getting a job and stuff. It wasn't encouraged, at least for me, it wasn't. It was suggested. It wasn't really encouraged. And you come out here and there's people who, by like 10, they were already told, hey, this, you know, they were already knowing how to, you know, go get a job and all that stuff. That wasn't encouraged. It wasn't, let's say that it wasn't a culture. It was kind of just encouraged for us, you know. It wasn't really, you know, so the time, so, you know, for most people, they were taking their time in their 20s just figuring it out. So, you know, and it wasn't something, but you, I know that pressure where it's like, oh, you're wasting time. Get to this point, at this age, you have to have this, this, and that by this age. And it's like, ooh, you know, let's slow down. You know, there's hey, for me, you know, just like, yeah, let's slow down a little bit here. Let's figure this out.
Yeah. And, I, you know, that whole time, that kind of freaked me out because I was in my mid-20s at the time, and I was like, yeah, you know, when you get that catch-22 and you're like, you know what? All the people that I kind of knew were already getting married, established, starting lives and things like that. But then you have this thing in yourself that's telling you, you know what, dude, I don't think you're in the right place. And I was taught for such a very long time never to trust that voice. My gut feeling, yeah. Like, this is not right. Like, I was always expected to appreciate the oversight and experience of people older than me. But then I began to slowly learn that age is just a number. Like, you can be 153, but no jack shit about what's happening in the world right now and what's happening to a specific person, because it's the complexes, the like at the beginning, the dual complexes that we grew up with, the lack of independence, the teaching independence, because I think you were lucky because you unlearned that in an environment that allowed you to do that. Like, you unlearned the whole, I must seek approval or permission to do things. I think you did that a lot.
Oh, yeah. I had to, yeah, that was something that was, yeah, I was a kid who did the opposite of that for a long time. You know, I did as I was told, ETC, ETC, and all that stuff. You know, the good boy, the Boy Scout. And yeah. I had to kind of, and it was to a fault. And then I had to, like, once you're alone, you have to unlearn, or at least it wasn't hard for me to unlearn it. Let me say that. It wasn't hard for me because I think I had become very independent towards the end before I left. You know, so I began to kind of explore the independence. This came too late. So, but yeah, by the time I got out, I was now unlearning. To a point now, I think I've completely, now, of course I have to, right? You're a grown man now. When you get to this age, you know, by now you should be. But yeah, it was really, you know, it was a process of unlearning that get approval and, you know, the whole being a Boy Scout.
Yeah,
it was a process.
It took me longer though. Like, it took me until I think as late as when I was 27 to unlearn the whole programmatic principle of asking for permission for things. And it's always, I always remember that line from The Godfather. I think it was The Godfather. It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. Like, I don't understand. It is what it is. Like, you can't say no. And asking permission means the person can refuse even without understanding what you were trying to do. And if it doesn't succeed because you didn't even attempt. But in the case you attempt, you fail or succeed, you then either in failure have a lesson, in success have a case study. So exactly. I then learned that's the best way to operate is to be like, as long as you're not doing anything.
Bars, by the way. That was bars.
But no,
it clicked. They're like, woo, boy, preaching.
But dude, it's that thing that, you know, we were always like, at least in my experience, I was told to fear failure. That failure is the end of the world. You could never fail. But at this age, I'm like, no, failure is a lesson. Because if you catalog your failures, you have a good map of what might not work now, but could work later, or what just won't work. So when I went through my 27th year and 28, I began to learn that, no, they are older, but they don't necessarily know what's best. And that I need to shave off that respect. In terms of my personal decision making, they can do everything else. You know, we can wax lyrical about life and all that nonsense. I can hear stories from my old man saying, "I'm Vanna. When I was your age, I had 4 kids," and I'm like, "Habibi, no, no, not in this lifetime. I'm good." But I began to shave that away. When it comes to my person, what I want, At this point, they no longer have the kind of hold they did back then. Because now I do what I like. Like I if I bankrupt myself in pursuit of what I love doing, that's great. It's on me to fall on. It's not theirs to kind of command. And they will side eye you saying, oh, you should have used your money for this. I'm like, you know, I see the value in this, the things you taught us, like, you know, get security, you know, get a property, et cetera, do those things. That's good. The problem is that we are not as financially flexible as you think we are. And the lack of us being able to take risks just narrows how much security we can have in the future. Because risk is weird, because you think of risk as this, like jumping off a cliff. Mm-hmm. It's a calculated descent if you kind of know what you're doing.
So yeah, exactly.
You might land somewhere better, but at a lower peak than you were at, which can help you build off of that, to be honest. And especially my parents never got that. They never got that whole, sometimes diving into the blue is a good thing because you don't know where you're going to land. This whole trying to build bridges and scenarios doesn't necessarily work. So even if they say like the whole degree route, get a, you know, buy a property, do this, that's great. Problem is that buying a property in itself is a whole responsibility that I don't have the finances to be able to support. So you have to then wait, am I willing to hold over this? And I'm not saying I can afford a property, by the way. Like, I'm just using it. But it's like taking that risk to be able to accomplish something.
Yeah, put
me in a position that gave me a little bit more power. And I felt like that's the lesson I should have learned when I was 17, 16. Because if that, like, I'm not saying I regret. Okay, there's bullshit in this world. People will say I have no regrets. Bullshit. Everyone regrets something. You're probably over them now. You're probably over the things that you
probably don't care about. It exactly. Yeah. That's probably. I see the same way. You may not care about it, but there's no way you don't regret doing certain things.
Yeah, and like that's the one thing I regret never learning, or never being taught, or never seeing for myself when I was younger, to be like, risks are a good thing to do. I remember if it was S-Dot who didn't go the traditional route. And he's doing pretty well. He's doing really well. I saw him on LinkedIn with a bunch of awards, and I remember we had a dinner at Village. Was it in 2015, 2014? With, I think, was it Fungai? I don't remember when it was.
Oh, were you there for that? That was 2012 when I was last.
2012, yeah.
Yeah. We did do that. Yeah, I don't know where we went, but we did.
It was a Village somewhere. I don't remember what the restaurant was, but
it was Village. Yeah, I think it was Village. I think we went to Miller's.
And then we were, you know, I see S-Dot's wisdom now. Like I don't remember the conversation in its entirety, but if you didn't revert to the traditional route, I see the wisdom in it now. That betting on yourself is one of those things that is valuable, that you should know, you know, when you're young. Understanding the economics of your tertiary education and how those resources could be diverted to something, especially if you're talented in something. Don't never diminish someone's talent so that they can, you know, be beaten into a mold or fit whatever mold you want society or society should think, especially Zim society, which is very backward. I remember I had this thought a while back, I think it was 2011. I was like, you probably, had you gone into music proper with Rimbing and all that, you could have been probably, let's say, a hair ahead of Manos in terms of just proficiency and ability. And it wouldn't have been limited to just ethnomusicology. I think it would have been music production and creation in general. But that just doesn't retrospect. Because at the time, we couldn't say that stuff. But I'm going to spend the rest of my life playing ribs. You couldn't say that.
Yeah. I just, for the record, Manos, if you're listening to this, those are his words, not mine. You're still the greatest. I respect him. He's on my phone. He's like, Ewe. But yeah, I think people have told me that a lot. And I think you couldn't. Because, like I said, it comes back to that thing. There's no security in it. There's no proven, you know, like James is one of those guys who he has this thing he always says is, prove it to me. Let me see that this formula works before I believe in it. You know, and that's because that's how his mind is built. You know, that's how he's built. And there's a lot of people who are built like that. My dad is one of them. Because he, you know, and so because being a musician and all that stuff, there's a lot of risk in it for them. There's a lot of going that route and going through the, you know, through the arts and being, you know, finding that is finding a niche in that as you live, as your source of income and just your career in general. For them, it's like, you couldn't say that. You can't tell them, yeah, so after school, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and do a course in Rimbas and specialize in it and start teaching and then I'll join, you know, Coutinho and start building the Coutinho company with Manners. And they'll be like, what? That,
nigga, that
nanny with who? You know, like that, I remember thinking about that conversation being like, hell no. Like, I do not want to have that conversation with this person. You know, especially with somebody who, like, you know, somebody who wasn't even a supporter of me playing Rimbas, you know? So there was like, no, there's no way I was going to have that convo. So it, I think early on, the decision became for me is like, I'm going to do this for them. That pays a degree. That's when I'm now going to do my own shit. Because I've given you this, you know, what I owe you, that pays. I gave my all to you. I promised you a degree, I gave it to you. Now, I'm going to do what I wanted to do before, you know. And I think if I had gotten into Rimbas, I think back then for me as well, it was just, there was no real pathway to finding exactly what I wanted to do with Rimbas. I also learned it, like I was also learning it 2 hours a day, twice a week, 2 hours. Yeah. So it was like, we had two practices, right? So just 4 hours, really just 4 hours a week, which, you know, compared to all the hours I was spending doing Squale, it was just, you know, I mean, if I had the same amount just doing Rimbas, I probably would have then been able to then get into it like naga naga with no issues at all afterwards. You know, after I finished, you know, school with John's. But you know, because Anas Zed, they got a different education than I did to it, right?
Yeah.
Anas Zed, when they were coming in, they got a way more advanced education of it. And their music, I think it was also just the music department as well. Like, they didn't teach Rimbas the way they taught it at PE. So I remember going to some of those lessons being like, ooh.
Yeah. PE, to their credit, took it seriously. I think PE was one of those places that if you wanted to specialize in something, you had ample opportunity to do it. Like, people used to look down on PE and as a school, but that school, if you wanted to be in sports, Christ, they would give you every single opportunity to prove yourself in that sphere, music, whatever. I only saw sports and the music sphere. I never saw everything else, but I can say, you know, just from the outside looking in, I am extremely impressed at the kind of characters they were able to bring out from that school, which is different from John's, because what we did was niche. And especially when you're already niche and you're already doing something that's niche, you're not going to get the same sort of exposure as the more, you know, traditional stuff. And I can understand when you said there wasn't really a pathway for Rimbas. But that's the thing, is that I'm looking at it now, I'm like, the risk, to having taken the risk now, I know hindsight's 2020, and, you know, fair enough. But having taken the risk back then to get into an era now, this is the bad part, is that, you know, we are now shortening the timeline from 2009 to 2021. But like, to a point where music creation is now so independent and liberal, and people are appreciating and are seeing the value in other cultures in terms of music and what they bring into it. The kind of guesstimate or suggestion of where things would have gone from that point to there, like now, might have been incredible, to the point that it would have been an established sphere of music that collaborated with different aspects of other, you know, music. Because if you look at, for example, the way, like, there was this joke on Twitter that every hip hop producer was waiting for Hiatus Kaiyote to drop the album so they can bump some samples. And Hiatus Kaiyote is not a conventional band, but the way that people are looking for different sounds and textures, Rimbing is, it falls under that. And it's so authentically African that if, like, you and I, we know when someone's playing a glockenspiel on a xylophone, we know the difference. And you know, with the dexterity, we'll be like, nah, this is not an African. And Black Panther kind of graduated that. But it's so authentically African, and I wish it was like something could play for you, but I don't want to get copyright struck from Mike from Manos, because Manos would be like, hey, bring that shit down. You're playing 10 seconds.
Hey, we're gonna talk to him about that, because if we're gonna do a section on Rimbas, he needs to chill.
Yeah, he needs to relax.
he needs to relax, man.
Yeah.
Those copyrights, man. Hey, bro, I remember he hit me with one of those randomly, man. The copyrights. Hey, this music, copyright. I'm Dada. Wait, I thought we were cool. I thought I signed a contract with Dada.
Yeah. I think we did, though. Because I think we were...
I think we did.
I think the parts that went to production, like the ones he did with Godman and Zed for the first album, were probably the things that we went in on. But everything after that, we were pretty
That shit was a Bible, bro.
Yeah.
I got that CD. Yeah, it was like a Bible. I was literally in there just on a desk in my own room on the floor. I was on any platform I could find. I was just studying those. And it was... I remember the thing that stuck to me most about listening to those CDs first was hearing Manu's Brick. He'll deny this, but he did.
Yes.
Hearing him Brick on a recording, I was like, oh, okay. Superman is human. All right. Because you see Manu's play. Manu is flawless, man. Like, flawless with his notation. And back then for us, notation, for those who don't know, notation is just the accuracy of hitting the key. In the right spot, it's a big sticking point. You're playing rimbas. So, you know, it was a big thing that he used to talk about all the time. And mine was, and he always used to give me, so much crap about it. Like, dude, fana, notation. So hearing him play and it's just clean. And then you hear that occasional off key and you're like, that was like a small victory, man.
Yeah, it was a small victory. But looking back at those days, I'm like, yeah. Now, had it been taken like as a serious career path, it would have been interesting. Like, in an alternate universe, I think there's a version of us who went down that route and are probably enjoying if all things went the same way they did now. That risk of, yeah, let's see what we can take with this. Because even for Manos, like, doing that was a serious risk on his part because there was no reference point for him to start this. Like,
he's definitely pioneering.
So we then, like, us, like, our generation, probably not all of us getting that chance to take risks. We have fewer and fewer pioneers. We have fewer and fewer people who can say, oh no, I started this or I'm doing this. Like, being in the startup and business scene now, I'm getting to see that there are a bunch of Zimbabwean pioneers who are starting a bunch of things because they went against the grain. Because if you hear people, they did degrees in other stuff and now they're starting companies that are totally unrelated because they saw a need that existed in the community. And I feel like we could have had so many freaking pioneers. And I feel like the white kids got the better, you know, half of the education, you know, arguably, in terms of, you know, pursue your passion instead of pursue a career. Because I remember who was telling me this. Was like, I would rather fail at what I love doing than succeed at something that I resent or something that I find joy.
Because
I'm seeing that now, and like the risk I'm taking now, that whole, you know, taking everything I've learned for the last, I don't know, 2.5 decades, and then just shelving it and be like, yeah, you know what? You can occupy a space on the left. I'm going to look at you sometimes when I need help from you. But right now, not really what I'm doing. And then learning again and then starting new things like this and, you know, being willing to fail at it, but at least at the very least having given it an attempt. So like I said before, like, this could be one of those things that could be something, could be nothing, but we're going to learn a bunch from it. And even if it's not anything, it's something that we can then have a record of. In terms the many conversations we've had that we never recorded, and the things that we then like say, ah, but you said this, and we will have a record of that. So I feel like that getting comfortable with risk in that sense was something that was never ingrained, something that's very frightening. Hey, let me not lie. There was a period last year where I had no fucking clue what I was doing in my life, and I was like, you know what? We're freewheeling now, and the freewheeling stopped like November, December. I got my feet on the pedals and I was like, okay, I kind of know where I'm going now. Like, I have not quite understood how to ride this bike, but I think I have an idea where I'm going, to a point where I'm more comfortable, not necessarily totally comfortable, but like now comfortable in what I'm doing, and more in the sense that I now want to do more. I want to try out different things.
Yeah.
The feeling of risk is not familiar. There's, you know, calculated risks where I'm gonna be like, yeah, okay, this is probably going to work to this extent. That's the best I can guess. But when I take uncalculated risks, I'm like, yeah, listen, we're going to drop off. Let's see what happens. If it breaks, it breaks. So we'll figure it out. And I feel like the Gen Zs have got that on lock. Like,
these guys are
so keyed up on, we are not listening to what you guys are saying. Because Zim TikTok, dude, I got an addiction to TikTok. Now, this is a conversation for another day, but the amount of creators in Zimbabwe on TikTok, this is not just us, the salads. It's kids in, I saw a nigga in Gorumunz. Like, I recognized the place where he was because that's where our farm is. I was like, and it was shot on some ITEL. Now, ITEL cameras, you can tell. ITEL never prioritizes when it comes to cameras. So you can tell, okay, this is grainy footage and it says shot on ITEL. So you're like, yeah, right. But the fact that TikTok is one of those things that spread to through all stratas of Zimbabwe and young content creators are using it to branch out. TikTok, you can get royalties for your music as a Zimbabwean artist if it's used on TikTok. Like, people are now discovering that social media is the way. Instagram creators, YouTube creators, the amount of Zimbabwean, there are a couple of Zimbabwean comedians who are getting roles in Netflix films because of comedy and YouTube content creation. Dude, those are risks. Those are like insane risks to take, especially in this in environment in Zimbabwe where they say Magitara Abadare. But you got niggas like Holy Ten and I don't like Mbajapreza. Dudes are doing pretty well for themselves. But they decided to bank, I think to a degree, bank on their abilities than anything else. I think those are the two outliers of millennials, etc.
Dude, it's technology, it's really just taken off. And the platforms that have, you know, kind of been spawned from it, that have allowed all these different people to kind of get out there and, you know, like TikTok, for example, starts off as just people doing funny videos and then some people start taking it seriously and they get a following. And once you get a following, you know, then you got a thing going. And then people market it and then companies and big brands look at you and they say, hey, good following. Like, this is something that I'm paraphrasing Kevin Hart. He said this a while ago. And, you know, it's, I had no idea that the TikTok in market, or at least the TikTok scene in Zimbabwe, was that crazy. But I'm not surprised, you know. Like, you know, everybody has access to Twitter. Everybody sees what's going on Twitter. It's something that I was actually thinking, like, it's actually a good segue, because it's like something I was thinking about the other day about how, like, you know, like talk with, like, sports radio, you know, like how it's how you know the first take shows that we watch, you know all that stuff, how it took off for a period of time because they were doing barbershop arguments on live TV. That was the sell of it, right? Yeah. They were also, you know, covering with a little bit of analysis, but the entertainment is the reason why people wanted to tune in. That's the reason why I wanted to tune into Stephen A just to see all that, you know, them talking about whatever they were talking about, you know. But then it got to a point where we're at a point, especially after last year, where everybody was at home and everybody had nothing to do but watch, be on their phones and be online and watch things online and all these different things. And then all the fucking podcasts that came out of, you know, last year. Like, I want, if I could get a stat just to see the spike in podcasts from last year. I swear, man. Yeah. And it's a beautiful thing because it's not even just like you had a podcast that came out. You were doing like, you know, podcasts as well, like towards the end of last year. Right? That's how you got started with all of this. So, you know, and in Zim, there's so many things that were going on in Zim, you know, just on a digital perspective that I had no idea about that I started seeing. But it's because everybody has access now to Zimbabwe, to technology. They see people doing it on Twitter. They see people starting going from Twitter followers to Twitter celebs, to now having a podcast on, you know, that has a great following because people will follow you to your platform, you know, whatever platform you're on. If we're following your content on Twitter, we're going to follow you if you're going to make content, you know, bigger, whatever other content you're going to give us. So, and it's gone, you know, that kind of, those kind of people, you know, they, because they're on the platform like Twitter, where the whole world is there to see it, you get, you know, people in Zimbabwe, somebody in Gorumunzi looked at a TikTok, you know, profile and saw what they were doing and said, ah, we got Nimbo, you know, Nimbo Fungaba. And then he got into his own thing and he started doing his thing. And now, you know, and now the scene, you know, it gets like that now, whereas you're talking about Gen Z, where they, you know, they want to do this. The whole concept, they grew up in a different world than we did.
Yeah.
You know, so they, you know, they were encouraged to kind of get out there. Well, he's not encouraged, but the world was there for them. You know, imagine being, like, imagine us at like 14 with a phone, you know, like this, with the technology that we have now. But imagine us at 14 doing that. Yeah. Like, you know, like, being able to access all these different things. But like, man, like my T-Lies, my youngest, they were talking the other day about how, you know, like, we transfer business. It was Sky News, Sky Sports. in the morning. That was it. If you don't know your results, your transfer news, your coach, who the coach was, the tactics, interviews. It was Sky Sports at 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening. That was it. And then BBC. And then that's all you had. Now I go on my phone. There's 1,000 owns talking about Manchester United and transfer business and this and that. And there's so many reporting. Now we have access to journalists posting articles, giving insights, you know, and things like this. So much, you know, and that's just, that's, you know, that's that one side of it, you know. And from an Africa perspective, it's everybody being able to kind of go online and see these different things from the world and have access to the world and then taking those concepts and then using them in their own environment. Like the SA, you know, the SA scene in terms of like music and how it is distributed and then how, if you know, like, yeah, that's a whole nother episode about the music and how it, the music in general has been influenced. But, you know, like Sunil, man, Sunil is somebody like we can spend an entire episode talking about him, but is the concepts of music that are in, you know, the concepts that he puts in his music. You can tell it's a little bit of this and that. But it's very much rooted in its own African sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that, you know, at least for me, you know, it comes from just being able to have access to all this music and being able to study it and learn it. And just in general, just the celebrity, or at least the social scene, pop culture scene, sorry, in South Africa and in Africa in general, and how it's now beginning to transform. Like in Zim as well, like all the Zim celebs. Sure, there's parity, right? Like, you know, there's rich people and there's whatever, but the way it's being influenced because of people that now have access to all these different things from around the world. You can learn a culture on your phone. I mean, experiencing it is better, but you can learn about it on your phone as well. And you can pick up on so many different things now. So it's beautiful to see. And it's more beautiful to see that Africa and Africans in general are beginning to realize, you know, hey, we can put a stamp on the world and kind of, you know, stake a claim in it, you know, creatively speaking.
Yeah, to that, man. Like, it just reminded me of the Amapiano, like, kind of spike that happened, was it last year, a couple of years ago?
Ooh.
And then you get to see people, like, I remember we used to have this running joke back at school that South African house sounds the same. I'm like, oh, you haven't listened to the nuances. It's different. It's like, unless you understand, like, it's like a painting. Every painting is done on a flat surface in most cases. Let's just use paintings as an example. It's done on a flat surface, either be it wall or canvas. But regardless of what the scene is or the motif or the style, there are just nuances that, like Mass Music and Maphorisa and Kabza. If you're not listening to it, if you're passively listening, it sounds the same. But if you now pick out the peculiarities and nuances, you can then begin to understand this person has influences from this direction, that direction. This was a callback to the 2004 style house. And Africans are now incorporating, especially musicians, especially in terms of Zimbabwe in particular, guys like Holite and are now incorporating Western elements into their music, into Western motifs, Western wordplay. Because that's not conventional. I know that's Shauna, but... That wordplay, I've heard it somewhere. I've heard that sort of rhyme scheme and stuff like that somewhere. And then there are guys who are more, I forgot the dude's name, who incorporates more of that African Zimbabwean poetry, Shona poetry sort of rhyme scheme. And like you're bringing that to a technology or to a music that was built in another world and you're making it apply to this. So the access is an important thing. But the other problem is that access has not been distributed equally. So for the people who can get it, it's great. Because, you know, like obviously, you know, I'm in Zim, you're in Canada. I have Wi-Fi, which is somewhat reliable. Not everybody's got that because it's super expensive. It's still kind of viewed as a luxury, but they're entry-level ways to getting into it. Like, we always joke at work that WhatsApp is Zimbabwe's internet because the most you can really afford is a WhatsApp bundle, and that's where you get WhatsApp music, piracy. People get conversations, get the news from WhatsApp. It's like its whole super ecosystem. You can literally do business on WhatsApp. Like, you can buy... You can contact a merchant, buy from them on WhatsApp, and then they can come deliver it. You don't even need the internet. So the definition of e-commerce in Zim is just weird. Because it's still internet-based, but there's no payment system in the middle. Okay, there's EcoCash and stuff, but there's no fluid payment system unless you build like a bot that can do it from A to Z. So Zim was kind of like improvised when it came to how to use the internet. Because a homie of mine who's in America was like, I saw your article about... WhatsApp, this line about WhatsApp being the internet in Zimbabwe, that sounds unfair. I'm like, yeah, but the beauty is that people get exposure to things on WhatsApp. People, literally, there are groups where guys would be like, guys, I'm not DSTV. Formula One, everyone can keep me updated with the results. This dude is wherever he is. We're in a group of Formula One, and he's getting the leaderboard and stuff through Formula One. It never takes away his interest from the sport. It's just he can't access it because DSTV is like $60, $60-$70. Ain't nobody got time for that. Internet is expensive. But with $4, you can get 4 megabytes, of which can last you, if you're conservative, can last you a whole day in terms of, you know, just getting text-based messages and getting news and being aware of the world. So in Zim, the access isn't perfect, but what we have is a lot better than what we had. Like for us, we were literally SMSs and calls. So that is what it is. Dial-up was, if you're on dial-up, you couldn't, nobody could receive calls because they'd have a conflict unless you're uber rich and they're two different lines for your internet and for your landline. So if you're not, if you're
on the situation, first time 3G came, bruh. I'll never forget that, man. The first time Ikre dropped that 3G arm.
And that dongle that connect to your computer.
That's the one. Bruh, first time seeing that, you were like, you know, the Antonio Banderas arm.
Yeah.
The meme. That's what it was, man. You plugged it in, you said enter.
Yeah,
that was the shit. Yeah, that's just, you know, all my Canadian friends are like, man, he's old. But yeah, no, yeah, seriously, man, this is.
you might like the perception is that Africa is a village. It really isn't, but in some respects it is. It's going out there. And I guess I'm thankful for the exposure I got, even though I didn't enjoy it. Was that you get to a country where internet is like second nature, like you don't even think about it. It's something that is always there. And you come back to Zim and you then see the difference in it. So as much as I never enjoyed the experience of being out and, you know, doing things I didn't enjoy, the exposure kind of, you know, made me fortunate, made me feel fortunate about the things I got to see. And like there are people who are innovators who are going to be in that situation, who are going to say, let's do something about it. Because I think on service providers, the biggest two is Zol and Tel 1. So if you're on, I'm on Zol, so yeah, Zol's hella expensive. That's Strive Maseo stuff. That burns a hole in your wallet. But someone's going to come, like what Elon Musk is trying to do with like Starlink, that whole satellite network. BS Rayo, because yeah, bro, you're going to need like hundreds of thousands of those motherfuckers to even catch reception in Uzumbay, Baramapumbwe, down there in the asshole of Zimbabwe. So there's someone who's going to come up with an idea of how to make it better and easier for Africans to get more access. Because I think we are, I have this joke, we are one good cheap internet service provider away from Zimbabwe being revolutionized from the ground up. And in terms of people just seeing the world in different ways. we are cheap internet away. Dude, let me tell you, niggas will not. Once internet is to a point where we will have our own Pornhub, we'll have our own Twitter, we'll have our own WhatsApp. Niggas are going to, because niggas are itching right now. Good. They're going to set up business now.
Oh my god, I'm in tears. The thing that's killing me is that because I live in a place where there's like literally 5 different internet providers. So when you say it, for me, it's just from what I've understood. Yeah, it's just you say that, it's just hilarious, man. You were watching way.
Yeah, you'll see, bro. Once it becomes dead cheap, you'll see the way Zimbos will start to experiment.
Can you imagine the day people realize, yo, we can pay $70 a month and we get this?
Mm-hmm. Ah. Yep.
Properly. Fiber optic cable and all that. Whatever the latest thing is. I don't know what it is, but oh my god. And it's like it powers. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know the Wi-Fi. I don't know what this is. You said it's Zol and Tel 1 now. Well, yeah, what are their bundles like?
You can get like from something as low as 10 gigabytes, sorry, to something as high as like 200 gigs. I think Tel 1 is the biggest 200 gig, but you get like daylight and nightlight if you want. So you can buy a 40 gig day bundle and then get and pay a little extra to get a 30 gig between 11 and 6 a.m. So that's the one I usually run with because my consumption is not really that high during the day. So my Netflix and Amazon and whatnot, I do that at night. Like I just download and then just watch them later. But Uncapped is not that far. It's just once I get myself on Uncapped, it's a slippery slope. I just start liking things. Like it, I have to, you know, kind of reel in my savings. But for Uncapped, where you can do whatever you want, it's $100 upwards, which in terms of being worth it, yeah, if you're going to use it, it's worth it. But if you look at the people who actually need Uncapped, like in terms of $100, and if you could set up a hotspot like by a growth point, that would probably do more good for Zimbabwe, to be honest, than it being in my house. Word, man, like, serious. Because for me, it's like, what am I going to do with Uncapped? Like, I won't even get, like, not when it's not like back in Ukraine where we used to like hit terabytes level downloads in a month. I'm not really going to use it for that anymore. In Zim, it's probably like, yeah, for me, 100 gig night and day is probably enough. But if there was a way to pay for, like, for example, Nora Growth Point, to pay for a fiber, I think there's Telone fiber down that side, and just put like a router, open password, and just leave it there and just watch people congregate. Man, revolution. Televised.
Man, I hope the city gets that. Man, I hope the country gets that. Because it needs, I think it's archaic what they're going through right now. What's in place right now. And it kind of just, it does. Because I really feel like a lot of things would be solved if people, I think a lot of things would be solved if there was ZESA. As much, you know, I don't even know what the ZESA situation is there now. But I think that, you know, that's baby steps, I guess. Baby steps. If we can't sort that out, that feels like a big problem. It's going to take some time to sort it. You can, you know, knock out the little ones first. The internet provider, you know, that shouldn't be hard to knock out.
Yeah, this is still a problem. It just depends where you live. You can be lucky and live the side where we grew up, where it goes but doesn't go as bad as other places where they're like, we haven't existed since like last Wednesday. You know, water waste, Xinhua has never worked. Like, I don't remember the last time I paid for Xinhua. And we're still, someone in was like, they're billing us for VAT they're not giving us. Like, kiss the fuck. Like, you're all serious. Like, I see, why are you sending bills? Like, caps have been dry since the 90s. Like, can y'all be serious?
The nerve to charge that bill. That is just, oh my God. The nerve to charge that and send that bill. Like, God. Yeah. Like, just here, imagine. The water's off, but you owe us this much.
Just imagine the paper that bill is printed on is expensive. That I have to get it to you, which costs money. Like, can you guys just send me a text? Like, find a way to text me that bill instead of wasting money. And that's just the backwards way that Zim is. Zim is just like that. Some things don't make sense. Like, I remember this week I was talking to a guy, Prosper Mwetzi, he's like a blockchain dude. And he was like, you realize that some countries are now dabbling in, like, I know we're getting completely, of course, yeah, but just a note to end on is, like, some countries are now looking at doing elections via the blockchain. So, essentially, we're getting rid of ballot paper, ballot boxes, and ballot counters. The blockchain will just freaking do that. You vote securely where you are, it gets counted, and you can even get, like, a live ticker of election results that happen. I think they tested it out in America with the army. Like, you know, people abroad can then vote securely. And it's like, he said it was asinine the way that African countries haven't adopted the blockchain in that respect, because the budgets that go towards elections are ridiculous. Like, it's insane. Mm. You could build a system that works every time, where everyone can register securely online, where it's quote unquote free and fair. But even said, like, you know what, it's not beyond manipulation. So you can't say it's gonna solve all the problems. But at the very least, it makes sure that you're cutting down costs of sending, you know, Zimbabwe Electoral Commission people to the corners of the country, fuel and the food they'll need, and paying them and papers and counting, where you could literally have a live ticker where people will just log in and look at, oh, right, he's in the lead now. Interesting. And you go about your day, and it should be that simple. But again, Zimbabwe is never that. Africa in general is just never that simple.
Never be. It's like, that's why, you know, a friend of mine was, she was talking about, you know, what's, you know, they're considering moving out of Miz, you know, Zim, sorry. And, they're trying to get, you know, just gathering information. I remember the first thing I said is, look, home is home. I get that. But for me personally, like being able to wake up every day and go through the ups and downs, you know, some days you just don't have it. It's just not there.
Yeah.
You know, you just wake up and you're like, ah, NASCAR, my one. You know, you know, and the thing you want at that moment, because the peace of mind to know that you can switch on the lights, my getaripu. You go into the bathroom, you open the, you know, the vat's there. You know, and now that you've mentioned it, that you're getting billed for things you're actually using, like, it's, I cannot stress how, as somebody who went through waking up, this, you have to go turn the generator on, and you have to come back, there's no vat, so it's bucket shower for you, and going through months to a year of that,
That
peace of mind knowing that, because it's one thing, people don't understand, it's one thing to wake up on the wrong side of the bed. It's a whole nother experience. Like, there's a different level of frustration to reach when you wake up on the wrong side of the bed. Kusinama gets bura. You don't understand. Like, you will, it's like, you know, it's like when you're, you know, when you had a bad day, you come home. It's a joke I've seen on Twitter so many times. It's hilarious. But you come home and like you're so frustrated, and then your fucking pocket gets caught up in the fucking. It's a doorknob, and you're like.
Jesus.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like that's the level of frustration that somebody reaches. Like when you wake up, just you don't understand, man. Like to the point now where I don't even think about it, and I always get, and I always have to remind myself, because you know, Anamanta tell me all the time, like, yeah, today I've got my kids, you know, there's no water, so also the seeing fire, and I have to remind them, like, yeah, okay. That's why I was like, I could never come home. Like that adjustment process on its own. Just remember, like, and thing is, like, I don't know about your mom, but my mom was violent in the winter. In the morning. So that was violence, bro. She shows violence every day. Every day. And the thing is, people don't understand, man. Anybody who, you know, any Canadian friends of mine, they don't understand. There's no fucking central heating in Africa. Yep. There's no indoor heating at all. It's literally you're with God. You're with Mother Nature. If it's cold, it's cold. If it's hot, it's hot. That's it. So in the winters, it is fucking cold in the morning, bruh.
Yep.
And she would come in, open all the windows, fucking remove all the blankets, the gumbezi, and say, let's go. Every day, bro, it was violence. Violent. And then you wake up. Now you're pissed. It's 4 or 5 in the morning, and you're pissed. You only because you barely sleep in the winter. You know, there's no sleep in the winter. So now I'm angry. I'm frustrated. It's 5 in the morning. I gotta go to school. High school, the worst place and the worst time in your life.
Yeah.
Worst best time in your life. And then there's no more gets. Ah, dudes.
And that bucket bath will humble you. That bucket bath will humble you. Like the cold, like niggas, like underage showers. Cause like this friend of mine was like, when we moved into Ukraine together. And I just sat there and I was looking at the washing machine. And he was like, is this the first time you're seeing a washing machine? I'm like, no, we've got a couple at home. It's like, so why are you so fascinated? Like the rarity of which we actually use them. It was so rare to get to the point where we were like, you know what, let's use them. Not because we couldn't.
We had one too.
But electricity.
We had one too.
It's just like, he's like, so are you like, why are you watching? And I'm like, dude, you will never know the pain of waking up on a winter's day. Especially a weekend, being woken up. Because again, like my mom would make sure we were up around 7 on the weekends. And especially when I got old and met, like, start washing our own clothes and stuff like that. And washing a dirty jean in cold water after having taken a bucket bath. Like, bucket bath, guys don't get that bucket bath. You are, like, people say you feel vulnerable when you're naked. A bucket bath makes you feel even worse because one guy, when the warmth hits you, it's temporary. It's like that shitty relationship you're in a couple of years ago that you thought was going somewhere. And then the cold hits you again, and you're like, and the time it takes from stepping out of the shower to getting into a towel to then putting that thick layer of Vaseline to be able to insulate yourself, the torture in between that. Niggas don't understand.
Man, dude, it's like that, just not that. I think I am so glad we free. I don't know. Maybe it's just my experience, but man, they sold us a lie with Vaseline, bruh. They sold, that was a terrible lie. This was a terrible thing that they taught us. I needed lotion, bruh. Like, also going to school. People were going to school at Penya somewhere. Like, I cannot imagine Vaseline now. I used to rub all of that. Hey,
bruh. And those niggas, when I had to walk, and you get hit by that film of dust, and then there's chills on your face because the vest is like, it's crabby. And then when you try to rub it off, you then give yourself third degree cuts or some shit because they're like dead dragons, that bitch.
There were real people who did that to say that happened. It happened too many times to so many people. It came in shining and then that dust. dude. No, man. Look, it's just in hindsight, man. I'm so glad pictures and camera phones weren't a thing back then. Because we used to come to school shining, bruh. Like, just, ooh, cling. That little sparkle sound effect, bruh. That's what it was like. Mm. But hey, man. Hey, anyway, look. To cap this off, I think we've waxed about 5 or 6 different subjects here. So this is going to be an interesting thing to watch back. There's one thing I wanted to touch on, or at least get your opinion on. Mm. And I've been thinking this for a while, and it's corny, but I've been thinking about it. Zidane. I want to touch on sports. Zidane. Remember I gave you that theory about Zidane?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I truly believe it. The theory is, you know, I think he spent the last 4 or 5 years learning how to fucking win pressure situations, pressure games, tournaments, and all that, learning how to build a team that's built to win a tournament.
Definitely.
I feel like he used Madrid as some stepping stone to, you know, because this is coming off the heels of the Euros where I think Deschamps was all kinds of, just made all the worst decisions. The talent he had, the slander on him was not enough.
Deschamps is private school Southgate. Like, people just don't get how similar those two managers are. And it's kind of the same.
Oh, yeah.
And Arteta, I think Arteta is just the death of, he doesn't have the talent to make it make sense. But your theory is correct. I think the fact that Madrid were able to win all those Champions Leagues consecutively, the way he built that team to thrive in situations where the Bernabeu was genuinely scary. Like, people don't understand. Like, the Bernabeu was Camp Nou from like 08 to 2014. We're going there was just a suicide mission, unless you're Chelsea, who then, you know, that one Torres chip and you got lucky. But he built a team that was super resilient, that was super competitive in cup situations. And I think that was helped mostly and I think it's personalities too. Because remember leveraging Sergio Ramos, who people underrate as a personality in terms of what he brings as a leader, the confidence that he gives.
He was a supreme leader. You know what? It came to light after those championships, those UCL championships that they won. But you were right; it was underrated as just a leader before that.
Yeah, and like Toni Kroos and Modric in midfield, like Toni especially. Christ, like I jizz enough about Toni because I watch highlights of his passes and his ability, and I'm like, at some point this shit was unfair. Nobody brought this up. It was like the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers back when Commissioner, it wasn't Adam Silver. The Commissioner was before Silver. So like, nah, CP3 is not going to the Lakers. Like, no, somebody should have stopped that transfer from happening. Because without Toni, that thing does not work. And Toni, again, being like very understated in terms of personality, but being super functional and like even going into the deeper role and becoming the Xabi Alonso. Because again, people, I guess the thing I've been saying for years, like Xabi Alonso was replaced by Toni Kroos, but not in the most direct way. And the way Zizou leveraged that to get this midfield, he's a midfield maestro and very like kind of carrick anticipative defensively, not as proficient, but like in the same sort of.
Casemiro was the biggest, at least for me, that was, because I know Zidane was the one who said, that's the guy I need, you know, because he built it. Because the greatest midfield he played in at Madrid was with Makelele. So, and he wanted that kind of player to be at the anchor of that team. Because he was the one that allowed Modric to do what he was doing and for the Kroos to be what he was. It was the perfect system where it was 6, 8, and 10. It was the perfect, that kind of combination. And it worked beautifully. And then you had Marcelo, who, you know, one of the most intelligent footballers and most skilled footballers as well.
Yeah.
You know, one of those Brazilians, he's one of the rare, you know, who kind of mastered the, how to play in Europe and then combined his Brazilian, you know, flair with it. And then you having the Ramos and Varane was like a perfect partnership, especially, you know, yeah, Varane around then. One of the best defenders in the world, bruh. One of the best. And it was he really, that team, they had a lot of luck. I will not lie. They had a lot of luck winning those championships. They will not lie about that. The refereeing, we'll talk about that in a, that's a whole nother episode. But still, the mindset, it's still hard to go that deep in the UCL. And to win, you have to win those games either way. You have to play in a way to win them. The Juventus game away, for example, that one year, you know, when Cristiano got an ovation in Turin, you know, that's one of those. There's one, you know, the series against Pep, you know, where Pep overthrew himself and got stomped, you know, and that wasn't even Zidane, but I know Zidane was an assistant in that one, you know? So, you know, there's things like that. There's just, there's victories, there's games along the way that you just know they were built. Even just this year alone, that's what solidified it for me. They went to the semifinals.
Yeah.
They got to the semifinals, you know? They were just not healthy enough. Yeah, and they were just not healthy enough to go through. They probably would have given Chelsea a better game, so healthy enough. But the fact that they got to the semis, yeah, there was luck in the draw and stuff. But, you know, it's just, I think it's the luck of it all, him being available for France, is just the fact that COVID fucked them up. And the real reason why he left Real Madrid is because he got no cash. They don't have the money to get who he wants, so he won't be able to rebuild the squad. So he said, I'm not doing this. So I think now it just works out now that he's in a prime position, because I think that France team needs him. There's a whole thing about club managers going to thing, but he's not a club manager in the sense of rebuilding a team. Because the Real Madrid team that he inherited, he didn't really rebuild it that much. He just kind of rethought it, you know, reshaped it, and gave it a little bit more, and just, you know, fed into the mentality of it and taught them a few more principles. But Ancelotti had already kind of developed them a certain way, and so he just kind of built upon that and added his own thing. So I think he's really built for a tournament. I think he's one of those ones who's built for the tournament. And if you gave him the France team, he just needs to reshape that team. The talent is there. He just needs to reshape it.
Yeah. I think it's looking at the characters they have in the French national team. I think Varane will step up as one of those defenders. He's not a Sergio Ramos by any measure, but I think he's competent enough because he's a top five, top 10 defender in the world. He's got Pogba in midfield, whose leadership abilities have been so underrated, and who got internationally slandered over the Euros. I remember Roy Keane and the usual Sky Sports, you know, BBC nonsense. Oh, Paul Pogba is this. I'm like, he was in the midfield with N'Golo Kante. He was not alone. Like, can you all literally see that he did pretty much what he was supposed to do? He was in good form the whole tournament. And then you got, I think Benzema coming back into the team is a game changer. I love Giroud. I think he's the biggest troll in football in terms of being a striker, a guy who's just talented enough and loved enough to keep playing for his national team, but in normal circumstances wouldn't make it there because other people would have been in that position that he was in. I think gives Zizou this team with the depth of talent. Like, people don't understand, France's depth chart is insane. It's not just this one golden generation. They've got another one brewing that hasn't been properly tested yet. Belgium is the one that I see with an endpoint. But in terms of France, they've got a very interesting depth chart in terms of positions. They were able to leave out a bunch of players because they could afford to do it. And I think if Zizou comes in with the kind of respect that he commanded in Madrid, like getting someone like Ronaldo on your side is not the easiest thing to do. It's easy to fall out with big stars and big players. We saw it with Luis Enrique and Lionel Messi. It's quite easy to fall out if you want to start imparting knowledge that they don't pretty much take to. But in terms of him having worked with, I think Ronaldo is one of the probably the most talented, and I don't know this for a fact, but I guess one of the most difficult people to work with in terms of getting what he wants, because he's super particular. He's so particular about the way he wants things done. And he doesn't do that like leading from the back. His body is testament to that. He's worked to a point where you respect the fact that he's like MJ, like Jordan. Like they're so particular to a point that when they want certain things, they need them, and it's easy to fall out with them. But I think give him this team, and he's got a generational talent. He's got generational talents in the France team. And I think that's the announcement I'm just waiting for. Zizou has now taken over the France job. In a perfect world, I hope he takes over England, because that would just be banter for days. But Southgate, they love Southgate that side, so yeah.
Oh no, Southgate convinced him to get young. If Southgate had gone out in the quarters, his job was gone. Yeah. The fact that he got to a final, now he's going to get one more chance. He's going to get one more chance, which, you know, I'm happy about, because I don't think he...
The comedy continues.
Look, Southgate, to his credit, on a chemistry standpoint, he understands that team. You know, he definitely understands that team. I think he's a little too cautious. Like, he lost that final really just by being cautious, you know. And, you know, there's things he needed to do in that second half earlier to kind of just say, fuck it, let's go get this. And so that's a thing that I think I'll give him. I just think they need a better mind there. It's really a Chelsea-Lampard to Chelsea thing. Yeah. I think Southgate is Lampard in this situation, and they need a Tuchel with a better mind to come in and be able to put that. Because if France's depth chart is crazy, so is theirs.
Yep.
Like, theirs is quite ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it is insane how crazy it is. Just the different ways they can go. The number, you know, like there's players that didn't even make the team. That are, you know, like Trent is young.
Yeah.
Didn't make the team. He's still there. Greenwood, he's still there. He didn't make the team. He's still there. Bellingham is what, 18? He's going to come into his own as well. So that's going to usher in. Phillips is young. Rice is 24. Shaw is 25. You know, so, hey, bruh. Rashford, Sancho, they're both sub 25 as well. Mount is sub 25. Foden. Grealish. You know?
It's scary team. Even especially in the striking department, there are a bunch of youngins are going to come through. We're going to, because they haven't really hit their peak. Instead, in terms of their prime, I think they're getting into it. I think with Shaw is the best example. Like, we're seeing Shaw really, really get into his prime now. After, you know, those two injuries and Jose Mourinho's torture, he's now kind of stepping out and becoming his own kind of man. Aaron Wan-Bissaka is another player who defensively would make England quite solid on the right side when Kyle Walker's time kind of falls off. But yeah, England are set for a while. I think it's just a different mind, because I think we talked about it when the final was going on. But you waited until the 180th minute to bring on Jack Grealish, like one of your most creative players, like the dude who literally at Aston Villa, no less, created so many chances, and you've got this much talent around him. He has like Jordan.
You need to get him in
Sancho
earlier.
Yeah.
You need to bring them boys earlier. Like Grealish, he needs time to get into the game, feel the rhythm, feel his way into it. And he would have killed. They would have won that game if he made those substitutions in like the 60th minute.
Yeah.
They probably another would have won that game.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, to all you listening, this is how our conversations go. Like, yeah, you're gonna get used to it. It bounces around. So next time, the title message is one thing, but you're gonna hear a bunch of stuff.
We will get more structured as time goes on, and we kind of flesh this out. This is introducing you. This is really just trial by fire, just, you know, easing in, just take all the shit and listen to it. Raw and uncut first episode to introduce you. And then we get more structured as we go along.
It can even become less structured, to be honest, because it's just dependent on how honest the conversation is. And I don't think we want to limit ourselves as well to be like, yeah, you know, we'll only talk about this. And then we will find ourselves in those rabbit holes anyway. So, you know.
No, and anybody that does come on here, they'll have to kind of, you know, adapt to the vibe. Because, yeah, the more unstructured it is, you know, the less structured it is, the better. Because that's just, that's just the spice of life.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much for putting up with us for like, I think it's 1.5 hours now. Almost.
Really?
Those two, I guess.
Yeah. If you survived this long, congratulations.
Yeah, you deserve a medal. I'll find one for you and I'll mail it to you. So yeah, we'll check you out later.